Thanks, Peter. So I guess we've heard mostly about intercellular communication and calcium waves in different types of cells. And as Peter mentioned, what I'd like to do is to talk more about how when calcium waves, calcium signals are generated in glial cells, how this affects the activity of neighboring neurons. And I'd also like, I've done a fair amount of work on characterizing communication between glial cells in an intact CNS tissue, the retina. So I'll talk a fair amount about that as well, what we found in terms of the mechanisms of propagation of glial cells in, of calcium waves in glial cells in the retina. So as way of background, and I guess there are a few physicists in the group, so please, if you have any questions about techniques or any of the biology, please just interrupt and I can, I'll try to explain. And let me just begin by saying that glial cells, as some of you know and probably some of you don't know, were traditionally viewed as passive support cells in the brain, supplying metabolic and structural support, but not really interacting actively with neurons. So this classical view of the function of glial cells is illustrated here, where glial cells surround neurons and they supply glucose and lactate and other nutrients to neurons, but they really don't interact actively on a second-to-second time scale. Well, starting about 10 or 15 years ago, it became clear that glial cells actually have far more complex properties. They have receptors, express receptors on the membrane that are sensitive to neurotransmitters, and so it was found if you cultured astrocytes and then applied various neurotransmitters, this evoked calcium increases in the glial cells. And in fact, if you stimulated a single glial cell either with a neurotransmitter or with a mechanical stimulus, this led to a propagated calcium wave that could travel between glial cells. And that's illustrated here. We now know that there are two mechanisms of propagation, which I'm sure we've talked about yesterday. One is the diffusion of IP3 through gap junctions linking glial cells together, and the other is the release of ATP, which functions as an extracellular messenger. But in addition to that, it was found working in cultured astrocytes, if you added neurons as well, that there was a two-way communication between neurons and glial cells. So, for instance, if one stimulates a glial cell in a co-culture with neurons and a calcium increase is evoked, this leads to a calcium-dependent release of glutamate, which is the major neurotransmitter in the brain. And this glutamate can feed back onto the presynaptic terminal and actually influence the release of neurotransmitter, or the glutamate can directly activate the postsynaptic neuron. And as I mentioned, the release of transmitter from neurons can also activate glial cells. So here you have a two-way communication, and in fact, we now believe that glial cells play an important role in many synapses of modulating the strength of synaptic connections. And in fact, some of us now call this a tripartite synapse because there are really three components to the synapse: the presynaptic neuron, the postsynaptic neuron, and the astrocyte that often surrounds the synaptic cleft. So, as I mentioned, this. Yeah.
When the glial binds presynaptically, is that generally inhibits release?
It can be both, in fact, and I'll show you examples from my own work. But it's been shown that if a metabotropic glutamate receptor is activated, that, at least in culture work, this is Phil Hayden's work, leads to an inhibition of release of transmitter. But if ionotropic receptors, AMPA receptors or NMDA receptors are activated, this can actually excite release of transmitter, and this leads to an increase in spontaneous miniature synaptic potentials that can be recorded in the postsynaptic neuron. And Mike Nedergaard has shown in the hippocampus that this leads to an increase in transmitter release from inhibitory interneurons to onto pyramidal cells in the hippocampus. So it can be either inhibitory or excitatory.
I always thought it's like the glutamate binds postsynaptically that it will give this rise to this miniature. That's not true.
Well, no. Miniature, you can't. I mean, that's one of the things that miniature endplate potentials are actually used as an assay of whether the influence is presynaptic or postsynaptic. And you can only influence the frequency of miniature endplate potentials if you, or miniature synaptic potentials, if you modulate release presynaptically. So if you see an increase or decrease in the frequency of spontaneous events, that means you're modulating presynaptically. So, a number of years ago, we decided to investigate whether similar types of interactions occurred in an intact CNS tissue. As I said, this work was originally done in culture. And we used the freshly isolated rat retina as our model system. And we've asked the following questions, which I'd like to address this morning. First, do calcium waves, which were first described in cultured astrocytes, do they also occur in a glial cell network in an intact tissue? And secondly, if they do occur, and I'll tell you right now that we found that they do occur, what is the mechanism of propagation? How do the glial cells communicate with each other? Thirdly, we use, and the work in culture used artificial stimuli to activate the glial cells. We wanted to know whether these glial cells are normally activated. Does normal neuronal activity lead to calcium increases in glial cells? In other words, is there a chance that this occurs in vivo? So we looked at that, and actually this is something we're looking at now. And finally, and perhaps most importantly, when glial cells are activated and show calcium increases, how does this affect the activity of neighboring neurons? So I'd like to go through.
You say glial transmission of calcium waves.
If there are neurons there, mm-hmm. you don't. I mean, a priori, you don't know. No, we don't know that the glial cells influence the neurons. That's right. Okay, so just to give you background on the system that we work on, this is the mammalian retina, and this is the back of the eye up here. The square, the outside of the eye would be up here. The vitreous humor is the fluid in the center of the eye, and here is the retina. And there are three layers of neurons in the retina, photoreceptors, and then horizontal bipolar and amacrine cells in the middle layer, and then ganglion cells are the neurons, the output neurons of the retina. This is, my thumb is going to be very strong by the end because it's very hard to push this button. the ganglion cells send out axons. The action potentials travel along the axons through the optic nerve. So these are the output neurons. And then in addition to these neurons, there are two types of glial cells in the retina. There are astrocytes, which are limited to the inner border of the retina. And then there are Müller cells, which are radioglial cells. They're specialized, They're specialized glial cells that are found only in the retina, and they span the entire depth of the retina. The glial cells are coupled together by gap junctions. So astrocytes are coupled to other astrocytes, and astrocytes are coupled to Müller cells by gap junctions. So the first question we asked is, if one stimulates a single glial cell, does this lead to a calcium increase, and is this calcium increase propagated? So we take a freshly isolated retina of a rat. We incubate it in a calcium indicator dial. We use 404 now. And this, fortunately, selectively fills, this is a, we use an amester, which is membrane permeant. So we just soak the whole retina in the dye, and it's taken up selectively by the two types of glial cells. And I think that's because these glial cells are the only cells that are at the surface of the retina. So we fill these cells here, and you can see these are the astrocytes on the surface. These are actually astrocyte processes that surround a blood vessel here. And these dimmer profiles are the end feet of the Müller cells. So we're actually looking at an optical section. We use a confocal microscope, which rejects out-of-focus light, so we can take a nice optical section. And we're looking right here, so we're looking at the calcium fluorescence in the astrocytes and in the enfeet here of the Müller cells. And then we stimulate a single astrocyte with, in this case, a mechanical stimulus, a probe, and this is what we see. When we stimulate an astrocyte here, we get an increase in calcium that then propagates to other astrocytes for quite a distance, 100 or 150 microns away. And you can see, again, we're looking down at the surface at lower magnification. These are all astrocyte cell bodies, and these smaller points are the enfeet of Müller cells. And you can see, I'll play this again, that in fact the calcium wave, once it's initiated in one cell, propagates into other astrocytes and into Müller cells as well. And this in fact was the first demonstration that calcium waves could be propagated between glial cells in an intact CNS tissue.
And then the movie stopped. Did the wave stop?
The wave actually stops too. And it stops about here, or I would have had it playing for a longer time probably. These waves are not, die out. They don't propagate with that decrement. They're not like an action potential that would travel forever. Interestingly, Helmut Kettenmann has recently showed a paper that's just come out in brain slices that if you initiate a calcium wave in glial cells, they travel for much longer distances. But in fact, those calcium waves are actually associated with activation of neurons in something called spreading depression. So you can have much longer propagation distances, but that's propagation is by a different mechanism in that case. So we wanted to find out the mechanism by which these calcium waves are propagated, and as you, I think you're all familiar, there are two possible ways that calcium waves could be propagated: by the diffusion of IP3 through gap junctions, or by the release of ATP. So we did a number of different experiments. The first thing we did was to look at the propagation at a higher magnification. So here we see one astrocyte. These are other astrocytes. These are the processes of the astrocyte. And we're going to mechanically stimulate this astrocyte here. And if you look carefully, you can see that there are actually two different types of propagation. There's a increase of calcium in the cell body that's stimulated, and then the calcium increase travels smoothly through the processes and actually into other astrocytes. So there seems to be continuous propagation through the astrocyte network. But there was actually a delay in the spread of the calcium wave from the astrocytes to the Müller cells. And so if you just concentrate right here, and I play it again, you'll see that there's a delay. There's actually a delay of about a second. And that suggests that there might be two different mechanisms of propagation. And ATP, we thought, might be involved. So we did the same experiment in the presence of cerumen, which is an antagonist to ATP receptor. So we're adding this chemical that blocks ATP receptor. So even if ATP is released, the cells, other cells, won't be able to respond to the ATP. And in this case, we see that the calcium wave spreads through smoothly through the astrocyte into other astrocytes here. And I think there's even another one up here. So propagation through the astrocyte network isn't compromised, but there's no increase in calcium in the Müller cells in between the astrocytes, suggesting that propagation from astrocyte, to Müller cells is via ATP. And this is a summary of two experiments where this is a pseudocolor ratio image of calcium increases. So in control, you can see that the whole field shows a calcium increase. In other words, the calcium wave spread through both astrocytes and Müller cells. In the presence of cerumen, where we block the ATP receptors, we see propagation into astrocytes, But the spaces in between where Müller cells are do not show a calcium increase.
This, of course, doesn't look too much like the cartoon we had before.
Mm-hmm.
In particular, you had glial cell,
mm-hmm.
gap junction.
Mm-hmm.
Where does one glial cell stop and the other one stop?
Well, that's actually a very good question, and very little was known about that until very recently. Mark Ellisman has done a very nice electron micrograph study, which indicates this is in the brain, so it may be different in the retina, but basically that an astrocyte has a distinct domain, and they don't really, neighboring astrocytes don't really overlap. And what's more, well, I guess a corollary of that is that the gap junctional connections are right at the tips of the cells. So that really doesn't answer your question here, but that's important. Well, right. You still can't tell.
You have this. It looks like a spider.
Right. It's hard to tell, and the finer processes probably you don't see because they're so thin. So I would have to guess simply that there would be. You just draw a midline between the two cell bodies, and that's approximately where they are. Okay, there are a lot. That's right. And here's a cell body.
These as being different cells.
They are. This is one cell. This is another cell. That's another cell. Yeah. That's another cell. But you can't tell. They're made only with the tips of their tentacles. That's actually the current model, although it's not known what the situation is in the retina, and it's very difficult. The problem is that the classical ways of labeling astrocytes don't show the entire cell. So it's a very good question, and we don't really know the full answer to that. But on the other hand, if you look at the movie, it looks like there's a continuous spread. So wherever the connections are, it doesn't seem to impede the propagation of the wave.
Right. The notion of a particular gap junction where it occurs doesn't really come out of that.
You certainly don't see that, although I think hasn't Andy Charles done some experiments looking at that, where you actually can, I think maybe Phil Hayden as well, if you stretch the techniques of calcium imaging, you actually do get a feeling of seeing where the wave goes from one cell to another.
It looks like sand.
Okay.
The dye going through the gap junction, splitting out.
Well, not the dye, but actual propagation of a calcium wave.
Calcium.
I think. But in this kind of movie, we don't see that. And there are other. There are other things one can look at too. For instance, hot spots of calcium release within a single cell. That can be visualized as well. And that doesn't, I don't know if that exists in the retina, but we don't see that. So we've also looked at propagation of calcium waves between Müller cells. So here, what we've done actually, this is a picture taken by Kathleen Zaz. And what she did was to inject a dye into a single astrocyte. This is not a calcium indicator dye. This is just some kind of label. And it actually spreads out to all of these cells because they're all coupled by gap junctions. And we took a sequence of sections, optical sections, with a confocal microscope, and then had the computer rotate the image. So this is a computer reconstruction of what a cross-section would be in any event. What we did was we experimentally did the same thing, where we took a retina and cut it into slices and turned it on its side. So we're looking at the cut surface of the slice, and then we can, with a probe here, we can stimulate Müller cells and see whether this, whether we can evoke calcium increases in Müller cells without stimulating astrocytes.
Is the Müller cells neurons?
They're glial cells.
They're glial cells. Okay.
They're glial cells. Müller cells are the other glial cells. So this, in fact, is what a cross-section a retinal slice looks like. We're looking down on the cut surface. Here's the inner surface of the retina. These are the end feet of the Müller cells, and astrocytes would be here. These are the cell bodies of the Müller cells. And here's our probe. And when we stimulate this fiber of the Müller cell deep in the retina, we see that there's a calcium increase that then propagates outwards and eventually reaches the surface. And sometimes it actually, the calcium wave spreads from the Müller cells to an astrocyte on the surface. But so we see that the second kind of glial cell in the retina, the Müller cell, can also sustain a propagated calcium wave. Okay? And in fact, what we find is that this propagation, again, is blocked by Suhrmann, indicating that the spread of calcium waves from one Müller cell to another is by the release of ATP. And because the propagation is spherical, kind of spreads out spherically, we think that all regions of the Müller cell can release ATP and have purinergic receptors, ATP receptors. So, we're counting on our model is that propagation from astrocytes to Müller cells is via release of ATP, and propagation between Müller cells is by release of ATP. So we wanted to test whether, in fact, ATP was released when we triggered a calcium wave. So we used an assay called the luciferase chemiluminescence assay. Now, was this discussed yesterday at all? No. Okay, so what this is, luciferase is an enzyme made by fireflies. And this is how fireflies generate light. So in the presence of ATP, the luciferase releases photons. It uses the energy in ATP and it hydrolyzes the ATP, releases photons. So if you want to know if ATP is around, what you do is you add luciferase and a protein associated with the luciferin. And then if ATP is present, you'll get release of light. So this is not a fluorescence assay, it's actually a chemiluminescence assay. So what we did was we took a retina, which is right down here, looking down on the retina again, and bathed it or superfused it with a solution containing luciferin and luciferase, and then stimulated the retina right here, and this is what we see. When we stimulate the retina, we see a release of light. This is a pseudocolor representation of the light that's released. So we get a light signal which indicates that ATP is being released into the bath above the retina. And in fact, you can see it actually spreads out. It looks like the release of ATP propagates outwards. And we can actually estimate what the concentrations of ATP are at the surface. And they reach, it says here, they reach about 80 micromolar. It turns out that our calibration was off by a factor of 2, so it's probably closer to about 40 micromolar.
What's the scale of that? How big is that?
Oh, sorry, this was, let's see, it may say, this is actually a much lower magnification. So this is a half a millimeter or more from side to side. So this is a line scan showing the profile of a chemiluminescence as a function of the distance across the retina, 100 microns. And as you can see, at later times, it looks like, again, the ATP signal spreads out. These experiments were done in the presence of cadmium, which blocks all transmitter release from neurons. So in theory, this would eliminate any ATP release from neurons. Reinforces our conclusion that this is ATP released from glial cells as they're propagating calcium waves. Now, you could argue that this spread of the chemiluminescence signal is not due to an active propagation of an ATP wave, but in fact is simply due to diffusion of ATP from the cells that were stimulated. But in fact, that doesn't appear to be true, because if you add Suhrmann, again, which blocks ATP receptors, you see that the chemiluminescent signal is restricted to a much greater extent. It doesn't propagate out. So to my mind, at least, and this is somewhat of a controversial subject, this indicates that there is ATP-induced ATP release in glial cells, at least in the retina.
I'm sorry, the Cerumen?
The Cerumen blocks ATP receptors. So the model is that ATP is released from the stimulated cells, diffuses through the bath, and then stimulates other glial cells. And then those glial cells, in turn, release ATP. And if we block the receptors for ATP, then the secondary glial cells can't be stimulated.
The primary was stimulated.
The primary are still stimulated.
And so the Cerumen doesn't block.
Right. And in fact, you can see that the actual increase, even at the stimulated cells, is lower. So that would indicate that even in the stimulated cells, they release ATP, and then this feeds back onto those same cells to release even more ATP. Now, that could be happening. There are lots of problems with this. For instance, the Cerumen actually interferes with the ATP assay, so you have to correct for that. But that's one interpretation.
Have you tried other?
Not for this experiment. I should have mentioned for the calcium wave experiments, we use PPADS, which is another blocker of purinergic receptors, and Apeiris, and they both had similar effects to Cerumen. And we may have tried it with the vociferous assay as well. I don't remember whether we did, but you do have to be very careful. The Cerumen cuts down on the luciferase signal by about 60% or so, 70%. So it's something you have to watch out for.
Is the range, the ATP wave, is propagating comparable? Is that the calcium wave as well?
Right here. So what you can do is to map out the leading edge of the wave as a function of time. So here's the calcium wave. These are averages over many experiments. And if you pick a threshold for ATP increase and plot out the leading edge of that, you see that it actually precedes the calcium wave by about a second. So the ATP goes up at some distance from the stimulation site. The ATP would go up before the calcium increases. And then again, you block the propagation of the calcium, of the ATP release wave, if you add Cerumen. And so this indicates that in fact, ATP is contributing, release of ATP is contributing to propagation of the wave, and in fact causes a calcium increase because it happens in those cells about a second before calcium goes up.
So these are all compilations of separate experiments.
Yes, they were not measured at the same time, that's right.
How about measuring the calcium when you're serving?
Right. We've done that. And if you just look, I don't think I have any pictures on me, but if you just look at propagation, well, we already saw that the calcium wave doesn't spread into Müller cells in the presence of Cerumen, because that's an ATP signal. But even astrocytes,
we saw that
in the presence of Cerumen.
Were you looking at calcium?
That was calcium. That was calcium.
Back.
Right. Actually, let me go back. You may be able to see it here. Well, you can't really see it, but what we find is the following. In the presence of this is calcium. This is calcium. That the waves don't spread through into Müller cells. But more than that, the actual total distance that the waves advance to is reduced in the presence of Cerumen. So even the astrocyte wave is smaller in the presence of Cerumen. Okay? So, in other words,
not a lot.
Actually, it's maybe about 70% of the full. You can't see it here. You don't see it in here, but you know, I have some other.
No, I probably don't.
Well, yeah. I don't know if I have them on me. Well, the diffusion coefficient of ATP is known. The obvious thing to do is to model this. we started to do that. Well, In fact, the calibration, we did model the diffusion of ATP away from the surface just in order to come up with a calibration for what the concentration was. We haven't, yeah, I mean, it's the obvious thing to do is to try to see, well, the simplest thing which you'd want to do is to see whether this type of spread can be accounted for by diffusion. And we tried to do that, and we never completed it. I think what we would find is that this pattern cannot be accounted for by diffusion. And in fact, this type of a profile fit better by simple diffusion, and this wider spread can't be. But again, we never really completed the study, so. But that's you'd want to do that. You'd want to do that, definitely.
The indicator used to show the amount of ATP.
Yeah.
But this is the use of the ATP.
Yes, it does. You have to take that into account as well. And in fact, I believe the time constant of decay, well, we found the time constant of decay was 75 seconds in our assay. However, you don't know if that's all due to the luciferase, which is using up the ATP, or whether they're endogenous ATPases. And in fact, there probably are. Well, there definitely are. The question is whether they contribute to reducing ATP within the bath above the solution. But glial cells, in fact, are known to synthesize these ATPases, and I'll actually have more to say about that later in the talk. So they're probably at the surface of the retina, at least. So there are several different enzymes that are chewing up ATP. And in the bulk bath, we found that the halftime of decay was 75 seconds. That's where why my calibration was off by a factor of two, because I didn't take that into account originally.
Do I have to match that profile with some function?
No, we didn't. I mean, again, the obvious thing to do would be to see if this could be accounted for by diffusion. It's not all that easy because this is not a point release in time. You have a both spatially and temporally extended release of ATP, and you don't know what that function is. So you'd have to make a lot of assumptions to try to fit it. That's the problem. That would make it easier, yes.
Yeah.
Definitely easier. That's the main problem of trying to model it.
But diffusion, you don't need to clear
time. Yeah, no, the actual diffusion is easy to model, but you don't know what the source is. The source is varies in both spatially and temporally, the source of ATP. So, and that has to be included in the model. Yeah. Okay, so if we put all this together, we find that calcium waves are propagated through glial cells by two mechanisms, by the diffusion of an internal messenger, which presumably is IP3, through gap junctions, and this accounts for a large fraction of the propagation through astrocytes, and also by the release from glial cells of ATP, which is responsible for the spread of the calcium waves from astrocytes to Müller cells and between Müller cells. And the ATP release also contributes to astrocyte propagation.
The other point is that this is a pretty heterogeneous medium.
Mm-hmm.
So
it is.
Of anything,
that's right.
Else will be hindered.
Well, and you have an interface between the retinal tissue, which has very small spaces between cells, and the surface of the retina, which is 100% volume fraction. So you're right. That would make it very difficult
so,
to.
I mean, the statement that we know the human
right.
Of ATP, that's presumably.
Yeah. Although I should mention.
Dependent.
I should mention that the fusion within brain tissue has been worked out in great detail by Charles Nicholson and others. And you come up with a modified diffusion coefficient due to what's called tortuosity.
Right, but I'm saying...
Yeah, I agree. I agree.
Not that you can't try to analyze it, but that it would not be universal.
I agree completely with you. And the retina is probably the most difficult tissue because different layers of the retina have different volume fractions and different tortuosities, right. And the surface is a huge discontinuity.
Yeah.
So we're in complete agreement. And that's probably why I haven't tried to model this. Okay, so as I mentioned, what we'd like to know is whether these kind of calcium signals occur in vivo. And I'd like to just show you some preliminary results which we've obtained recently, which tests whether activation of the retina with light leads to calcium increases in glial cells. So over the past 5 years or so, it's been found that in brain slices, you take a fresh slice of a brain, that if you activate neurons artificially with electrical stimulation, you do get increases in calcium in astrocytes, glial cells in the brain. And somewhat surprisingly, this signaling from neurons to glial cells is mediated by the release of a number of different transmitters, including glutamate, GABA. GABA is the primary inhibitory transmitter in the brain, acetylcholine, and nitric oxide. So in different tissues, the release of different transmitters can signal glial cells, and this leads to a rise in calcium in the astrocyte. So we wanted to find out whether the same thing was true in the retina. And the retina actually has an advantage, which is that we can use the natural stimulus to activate the neurons. So we flashed a light and then monitored calcium in astrocytes and Müller cells. And I'll show you another movie. This is a retina that we're focused just below the retinal surface. So these are the stalks of the Müller cells here. These are astrocytes here. These are, well, the holes in between are where the ganglion cells, the neurons, would be. And what we're going to do is, well, what we find, as you'll see, is that there are spontaneous transient increases in calcium in the Müller cells. And this is not extraordinary because the same thing is seen in astrocytes in the brain. They generate spontaneous oscillations or transient signals. And so we see the same thing here. We get this is without light stimulation, but then we're also stimulating with light here. So the experiment is the following. We look at the transients in the Müller cells for a control period, then we turn on the light, flash the light on and off, which will activate the neurons, and see whether there's a change in the calcium signaling in the Müller cells. And this is what we find. This is a recording of the calcium signal in a single Müller cell. And this is 8 consecutive trials where we turn on the light here. And actually, the light is actually a flashing light, which is optimal for exciting the neurons. And we find in each one of these trials, sometime during the light application, there is a transient increase in calcium in the Müller cell. And this is the average down here. So clearly, this Müller cell is responding to light with an increase in calcium.
And this is
presumably a spontaneous. And in fact, if we just record it in the absence of light, you'd see these spontaneous events, but they don't occur as often.
And this is a dye that is only in the Müller cells?
The dye only fills up the Müller cells and the astrocytes. But even if it didn't, we know just from the morphology that these are Müller cells. I guarantee you. Those are Müller cells, and these are astrocytes.
And you're looking at one cell.
In that case, we were just measuring the light, the fluorescence from one cell. I knew it was a Müller cell, and I knew that I picked out a cell that was responding. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. So you have a sort of a paradox here, which is that you have to shine a light on the retina in order to measure the fluorescence to begin with. And in fact, what we do is the following.
The so-called spontaneous.
Yes. So we have to monitor the calcium indicator dye fluorescence all the time, whether we want to stimulate or not. So what we do is we use a low level of excitation light for the fluorescent dye all the time. And then during light stimulation, we increase its intensity and flash it as so, and then we reduce to a low level again. And we can record from neurons and use the same light protocol, and we know that the neurons will start to generate signals only during, or much to a much greater extent, during this period here. So even though the light is on all the time, we can actually activate the neurons in this specific time. Okay. If we go back to this original experiment and look at all the Müller cells in a field for many, many trials and average everything, we come up with an increase in calcium indicator dye fluorescence that looks like this. So again, this shows the time course of the calcium increase in the Müller cells. So clearly, the Müller cells are responding to light. And we've quantified this in a different way by counting the number of cells that show a transient during a control period and during a test period. And we use an automatic thresholding macro in our image processing program that picks out the cells that respond, that they give a transient increase. And we count the number of cells in each of these periods, and this is what we find. Light stimulation, on average, increases the number of calcium transients in Müller cells by 36%. Okay, now what we'd really like to know is what the signal is between neurons and the glial cells. And somewhat to our surprise, we found that if we add TTX, tetrodotoxin, this blocks the increased calcium response. Now TTX is a poison, a pufferfish poison, that blocks sodium channels, so it blocks action potentials in neurons. So this, in general, this kind of result would not be surprising until you realize in the retina, most of the cells in the retina don't generate action potential, so they wouldn't be affected by TTX. It's only the ganglion cells, the output cells of the retina, in general, this is not strictly true, but let's just assume for now, that it's only the ganglion cells that are blocked by TTX. And these cells don't actually synapse, don't form synapses in the retina. So this is a rather surprising finding, but in fact we confirmed it in the following way. You can activate the ganglion cells selectively by electrically stimulating the axons on the surface of the retina. And if we stimulate the axons of the ganglion cells, again we get an increase of calcium in the Müller cells. And this, again, not surprisingly, is blocked by TTX because the action potentials travel through the axon. So this suggests that its activity in the ganglion cells, the output cells of the retina, that is signaling the Müller cells. And as
I don't understand what else, why is that, what else?
Okay. Let's go back to the very beginning. We find that we're actually focusing down here. We find that the calcium increase that we see occurs here, also occurs up here, but it's strongest here. So in fact, given where we see the calcium increase, you might predict that it's the axons of the ganglion cells that is responsible for signaling to the Müller cells. So that, in that sense, it's not surprising. However, in the brain, what's always been found is that it's release of neurotransmitters from neurons that signal the glial cells. Now these cells have neurotransmitters that are only released over there in the brain, because these cells synapse on cells in the brain. They don't synapse in the retina. So one would have to postulate that you have some kind of a release of some chemical from the axon, which actually has been shown to occur, but it's not sort of conventional neuroscience. You don't expect these cells to be releasing neurotransmitters along their axons. That's why it's surprising. One would have predicted that it's you know, maybe bipolar or Amerkin cells that release transmitters in this region, that would be responsible. But TTX, which blocks the calcium increase, shouldn't affect these cells. No, that's definitely not true.
So the TTX could affect lots of things besides the spike protein.
Well, I'm sorry. The sodium channels in ganglion cells are blocked by TTX.
Yeah.
So, in fact, what I said before, as I warned you, it's not strictly true, because many Amerkin cells also generate spikes. So they could be interfering with Amerkin cells. And in addition, it's been shown that there are sodium channels in bipolar cells that are blocked by TTX. And in fact, the light responses of bipolar cells are affected by TTX to a small extent. And this is a very surprising finding. I think it was only reported last year. So TTX could be affecting these other cells, although it's not. It should. But it doesn't block their activity completely. Doesn't block the activity of bipolar cells or Amerkin cells completely. What's more, as I said, if we stimulate these axons electrically, we get the response, which suggests that it is the ganglion cells. But you certainly can't rule out that it's these other cells.
So how are the ganglion cells communicating with the newer cells?
We don't know. One could postulate that some chemical transmitter is released either from the cell body or from the, well, somewhere along the ganglion cell. It can't be synaptic. It can't be released from synapses because the ganglion cells don't synapse in the retina. They only synapse in the brain.
In any case, they don't synapse with
Ian. Let me explain that there are, with very few exceptions, there are some exceptions now, neurons never synapse directly onto glial cells. But what is thought to happen, what's known to happen, is that there's spillover, so that the transmitters released at neuron-to-neuron synapses, some of that diffuses out away from the synapse and then stimulates the glial cell.
And that does not because there aren't synapses.
Exactly. Exactly. But there are reports that in nerve, which is made up only of these axons, in nerves, peripheral nerve, that some transmitters, I believe acetylcholine or maybe glutamate, can be released. And I don't know what the mechanism is, even though it's not a synapse. So it's not completely outrageous that some chemical could be released from the ganglion cell. So I forgot to preface, or maybe I did, all of this by saying these are preliminary results. And we haven't progressed any further, so we don't know what that chemical is yet. Okay. Now, we're going pretty slow. Is that okay? Okay. Okay. So that's what we've shown is that light stimulation, a natural stimulus, does result in calcium increases in Müller cells. We don't know about astrocytes. And so this suggests that calcium signaling probably does occur in vivo. Now, in anticipating questions you might have, let me just say that these calcium increases in single glial cells do not lead to calcium waves, to propagated calcium waves. And there's a big question about whether calcium waves do occur in vivo. And my guess, and I think the guess of other people who have worked on this, is that they don't. At least not big, robust calcium waves spreading for 100 microns probably don't occur under normal physiological conditions. But we can't rule it out. That's best guess so far. Okay, so I'd like to move on to the big question of which is the following. If you have calcium increases in glial cells, which we now think may occur in vivo, what kind of influence does this have on the electrical activity of neighboring neurons? And I'd like to show you several types of experiments we've done. The first was to monitor the action potentials, the spiking of ganglion cells, and see if that changes when we trigger a calcium wave in glial cells. And so this is the experiment. We take our retina, we take a metal microelectrode, extracellular electrode, and record the action potentials from a single neuron. And then we periodically, every 5 seconds, we give a flash of light and stimulate the retina, and this triggers light-evoked action potentials in this ganglion cell that we're recording from. Then after a control period, we stimulate glial cells, in this case with a mechanical stimulus, and trigger a calcium wave, and we monitor calcium, so we are simultaneously imaging calcium in the glial cells and recording the electrical activity from the single neuron, and then see whether this electrical activity changes when the calcium wave spreads past this neuron. Okay? So here's the setup. I'll show you a movie. Here's the metal electrode. We're recording the electrical activity, the spiking action potentials of a neuron here. We trigger a calcium wave here, and you can see it spread past the neuron, and we're going to actually measure the calcium fluorescence in this circle. So we're going to monitor the glial calcium in the glial cells that are adjacent to the neuron. And then in the movie, you're going to hear the spiking of this one neuron. In fact, you'll see it's driven by light. This light will be flashing on and off, and you'll hear the response of this neuron to that flashing light. And then, after a control period, a red disc will come on, indicating that we're triggering a calcium wave in the glial cells. Okay, got all that? That we're doing mechanically in this case. Okay, so here goes. Okay, let me stop right there. And let me quiz you. What type of a neuron was it? How was that neuron responding to light?
Before the light went off.
Actually, there are a few spikes before. It's largely a transient on cell. There's a big burst of spikes at the on of the neuron. What happens is that there's an inhibition after the light turns off, and then the spikes start coming back just before the light goes on again. That's why you thought it was responding. It's not actually responding before the light goes on.
If you could have timed that so that it wouldn't happen.
If the light flashes were closer together, that wouldn't have happened.
I would have thought.
Or if we waited long enough, it wouldn't. Yeah. Either way. But I think if you listen to the big burst, you'll find that it occurs just about right after the light goes on. So it's a transient on cell. It's responding to the on of light. Well, maybe, also I could have, synchronization could be off a little. By 100 milliseconds, maybe. It maybe does come before, it shouldn't. So we triggered the calcium wave. So I think you could hear that there was a change in activity. In fact, there was an increase in activity, and that's shown here. So what we're looking at is the following. This is a plot showing a running average of the frequency of the spikes. Do physicists use the term leaky integrator?
No.
Okay, so this is kind of a leaky integrator of the spike activity. It's an instantaneous frequency plot of the spiking. And this is the calcium indicator dye fluorescence in the glial cells next to the neuron. So we trigger a calcium wave here. Calcium wave reaches the neuron, and there's an increase in the spiking of the neuron. Okay. Now, you could argue that, in fact, the mechanical...
I don't understand. What is the origin on the topic of the frequency?
It is.
So it's an increase in the frequency.
It's an increase in the frequency of spiking, right. So you could argue that it may not be the glial cells that's resulting in an increase in frequency of the spiking, but in fact mechanical stimulus could be stimulating the neuron itself. But in fact what we find is that if we stimulate, these are three trials from the same neuron. If we stimulate, in a second trial, stimulate the glial cells, the calcium wave was actually initiated but then died out before it reached the neuron. And in this case, when there's no calcium, when the calcium wave doesn't reach the neuron, there's no change in the spiking of the neuron. And then in a third trial on the same neuron, again the calcium wave reaches the neuron and there's a big increase in the spiking of the neuron. Okay?
My impression when I heard that yeah. actually the activity increased, but it seemed to be less correlated with the light.
Well, in fact, this is the trial that you saw, and in fact you can see there's each one of these increases here is the response to light on, and it's somewhat smaller in this case. So you were right. And there's, and we never analyze these in detail, it'd be difficult, so we don't know. Clearly the background rate of firing did go up. So we saw an enhancement.
Those spikes have to do with the light.
These increase.
No,
oh, yes, yes. Each upward deflection here is the response to light. And because this is a leaky integrator, this decay is partially a function of how long we were integrating for. This is the light down here. Yeah. So we saw this increase in spiking in some neurons, but in fact in more neurons we actually saw a decrease in spiking. You can see here, and then when the calcium wave doesn't reach the neuron, there's no change, and in the third trial on the same neuron, there's a big decrease in spiking. And in this case, you can see, I think it was true for the increase as well, there's a decrease both in the light evoked response and in the, well, you know, because it's a, we're integrating, you really can't tell what the background level was. I should really replot these as a true instantaneous frequency plot, and then you could tell whether it's the background level has changed. No, you can't, because this is, again, there's a relaxation here, and even though it shows that there's some activity here, there may not be any spikes here. In fact, there aren't any spikes here. So the instantaneous frequency actually dropped to zero at this point.
What's the difference between these neurons and the
simple answer is we don't know. And we're still looking into that. Let's keep it at that. Well, there's a wide variety of ganglion cell neurons, many different classes. More are inhibitory than excitatory. But what I thought you were asking is, do we know, are a particular class of ganglion cells only excitatory and other classes inhibitory? And that we don't know. But in general, there are more of these than the ones that are excited. But why that is, we don't know yet. But again, I'll show you some other results which we're beginning to look at that. So in summary, for these experiments, 57% of all the neurons we characterized showed a significant change in spiking. Of these, 17% showed an excitation, and 83% showed an inhibition. But we don't know whether these were different types of ganglion cells. We also did some pharmacology, and I'll gloss over this because I don't know, this doesn't fit in. We don't know what this means yet, but if we look at just the inhibitory modulation, it was blocked. If we block glutamate transmission, these are antagonists that block different kinds of glutamate receptors, AMPA and NMDA receptors, and GABA and glycine, which are inhibitory transmitters. If we block those, we block the inhibition as well. But I don't want to dwell on this because I'm not sure what it means. So more recently, we have begun to characterize how glial cells can modulate electrical activity by doing intracellular recordings from neurons. And we're using whole cell patch recordings. And we are activating the glial cells now by ejecting agonists. And ATP gamma SSR is very effective, and it's also, as you'll see, it's important because ATP gamma S cannot be hydrolyzed, cannot be split up due to its special chemical structure. So it remains as ATP. And then we continue to monitor the glial responses by looking at calcium inside the cells. Now, I'm not sure, let me just show you this first. This is what our preparation looks like. So we are, this is infrared differential interference contrast microscopy. And it's a way, one uses infrared because there's less scattering of light in IR, so you get better detail. And DIC is just a way of increasing the contrast. So if you focus down about 8 microns below the surface, you go down to the ganglion cell layer. So these are all ganglion cells. These are the cells that send axons out of the retina. And in fact, you can see the Müller cells as well. Each one, that's a Müller cell, that's a Müller cell, that's a Müller cell here. That's probably a Müller cell and another one or two here. So one can visualize the Müller cells as well. But what we do is we patch onto the ganglion cell and then voltage clamp these cells to record synaptic currents. Now, I'm not sure, is everybody here familiar with voltage clamp? Okay, so what we're doing is just measuring the ionic currents generated. It's actually just a more accurate way of measuring responses of the cell. So this is the, I want to show you two more sets of experiments. This is the first one, and these again are preliminary experiments. What we do is the following. We patch onto a ganglion cell and measure the currents generated in the ganglion cell. We then flash a light repetitively. We stimulate the photoreceptors. This leads to stimulation of the ganglion cells, and what we record are actually the synaptic currents, mostly from bipolar cells onto ganglion cells. So these are excitatory synaptic currents, which would lead to depolarization of the cell. In the voltage clamp mode, you actually record inward currents, positive ions going into the cell. And then, again, so we flash a light repetitively. After a control period, we activate the glial cells to see whether these synaptic currents have changed. And again, these are preliminary experiments, but I'd just like to show you a few of them. So here is a trace of a synaptic current. We call this an EPSC, excitatory postsynaptic current. We flash a light here. We get a nice inward current, which lasts a couple hundred milliseconds. So this would generate a depolarization and lead to activation of the ganglion cell. Then, so we give several of these light flashes here to measure this synaptic current. Then we activate the glial cells by ejecting ATP gamma S onto the surface, and we find that following the ejection, we get an increase in the EPSC. The synaptic current is increased. So in fact, we've got a potentiation of synaptic transmission. Okay, synaptic transmission has gotten stronger. And this shows the time course of that. It only lasts for about 10 to 30 seconds or so after we activate the glial cells. Okay, so this indicates that activating glial cells can actually lead to an increase in the strength, a temporary increase in the strength of synaptic transmission. And this has actually also been seen in brain slices in other laboratories. Now, you could argue that the ATP, the effect of the ATP is directly onto the neurons, not onto the glial cells. And in fact, I just reviewed a paper yesterday that shows exactly this, that ATP can directly act on the presynaptic terminal of neurons to increase synaptic transmission. So that this doesn't, certainly by no means does this prove that it's the glial cell that's potentiating the synapse. However, we think it is for a couple of reasons. One, the time course, but in this particular experiment, we did something else as well. We were able, recording from the same neuron, we were able to activate the glial cells with a completely different kind of stimulus, a mechanical stimulus. This also triggers a calcium increase in the glial cell, and we see the same type of potentiation. So using two different types of stimuli to activate the glial cells, we get the same potentiation. So we think, in fact, this potentiation is due to the action of glial cells.
You didn't have to time it somehow the stimulation.
I'm sorry?
I mean, you get to time the stimulation of the glial cells.
With respect to the light?
Yeah.
Well, the light is coming every 5 seconds, and the potentiation lasts for about 20 or 30 seconds, so you don't have to do that. And then, in another cell, another neuron, we see the opposite effect. So here we flash a light, we actually get a more complex response. This is an inhibitory current followed by an excitatory current. And again, we activate glial cells with ATP gamma S, and in this case, we get a decrease in the current. But actually, what's interesting here is that we get a decrease in the excitatory synaptic current here, but there's no decrease in this initial, or a very small decrease in this initial inhibitory current. So here, when we activate the glial cell, we are selectively modulating the excitatory synapse, but not affecting the inhibitory synapse. And again, we think this is due to activating glial cells, but this certainly does not prove it. And there are a lot of more experiments that have to be done. So I'd like to just show you one final series of experiments where we characterize another type of modulation of the neuronal activity by glial cells. So here, I just presented evidence that glial cells, presumably neural cells, can either potentiate or depress synaptic transmission. So that, in a sense, is two different mechanisms of glial modulation of neurons. And here I'd like to describe a third one. And the recording procedure is similar, except we're not flashing a light. We are activating glial cells by agonist ejection and then recording currents in the neuron. And what we find is the following. We eject ATP onto the surface of the retina. This leads to an activation of the glial cell. So we get a calcium increase in the glial cell. And in some neurons, we record a very large hyperpolarization. And if we voltage clamp, we get an outward current. Okay? And we don't see this in all neurons. In 36% of the neurons we recorded from, there's no neuronal response at all. In about half the neurons, there's a small hyperpolarization. And in a small fraction, 12% of the neurons, there is a humongous hyperpolarization. I mean, this is about 7 millivolts lasting for 20 or 30 milliseconds. This is really going to change, dramatically change the behavior of the neuron. And, in fact, here is a neuron that's showing spontaneous spiking. And when we stimulate the glial cells and we evoke even a small, about a 1.5 millivolt hyperpolarization, this changes the spiking pattern quite noticeably. So even small hyperpolarizations will lead to a change in the behavior of the neuron. So we wanted to know what the mechanism was by which the glial cells were hyperpolarizing the neuron. And so what we did is try to block different neurotransmitter systems by adding blockers or antagonists. I'm ahead of myself here. One could argue that that the ATP is not causing this hyperpolarization by stimulating glial cells, but by directly stimulating the neuron. Okay? And that, we think, is not true because we can stimulate the glial cells by many different mechanisms, just like I showed you before with mechanical or ATP. In this case, we can add many different unrelated transmitters or agonists, and they all produce calcium increases in the glial cell, and they all inhibit neurons. So we can use ATP, ATP gamma S, dopamine, thrombin, lysophosphatidic acid, or mechanical stimulation. They all lead to this hyperpolarization of the neuron. So we think, in fact, that in this case, it is definitely the glial cell that's mediating the hyperpolarization. The next thing we wanted to know is whether the hyperpolarization was due to a direct action of the glial cell onto the ganglion cell, or whether this inhibition was mediated through exciting a inhibitory interneuron, the amacrine cell, which in fact is what we thought was happening, because if you remember, if we block GABA and glycine, we block inhibition of the spikes. So what we did to do this is we block synaptic transmission by adding cadmium, which completely eliminates synaptic potentials. And then we saw whether that effect, that treatment, changed the response, the inhibitory response, and it didn't. So again, we are exciting the glial cells with ATP gamma S. This result, not shown here, this increases calcium, and then this, in some neurons, leads to an outward current. So this is the inhibitory response. We add cadmium, which blocks synaptic transmission. There's no change in this response at all. So we block the synapse. We still get the hyperpolarization. That means that this pathway through the inhibitory neuron is not functioning. And in fact, glial cells are directly inhibiting the ganglion cell. So this is not effect on synaptic transmission. So it's different from the mechanisms I showed before. We did other experiments, well, I'm not going to show you the results, where we selectively activated either astrocytes or Müller cells to determine which of these glial cells is inhibiting the ganglion cell. And we found that exciting Müller cells was both necessary and sufficient to see this inhibition. So it's the Müller cell that's doing the inhibiting, not the astrocyte. And then we wanted to know what is it that Müller cells are releasing to inhibit the ganglion cell. So we added blockers of different neurotransmitter systems. And somewhat to our surprise, the common neurotransmitters are not participating in this inhibition. So we can block glutamate transmission, GABA transmission, glycine transmission. These are inhibitory. Acetylcholine transmission. None of these affect the inhibitory response. However, if we added an antagonist to adenosine receptors, the A1 receptor of adenosine, we find that even very low concentrations, 5 to 10 nanomolar DPCPX, which is a blocker of this A1 receptor, completely eliminated the response. Okay? And so this predicts, suggests that in fact it's activating adenosine receptors that's causing the inhibition. And in fact, if we directly eject adenosine onto the retina, we see a response that's more rapid and larger than the ATP response. So here we're activating the glial cells. Here we are directly activating the receptors on the neurons, and this also generates the inhibitory outward current. Okay? So what's happening? Well, what we thought was happening is the following. I already showed you, and other people have shown this, that ATP is being released from the glial cells, from the Müller cell, when they're being activated. Now, it's known that, and we talked about this before, that there are enzymes in extracellular space that hydrolyze ATP. And in fact, it's known that ATP released into the space between cells in the brain is rapidly converted to ADP, AMP, and then adenosine. And this conversion occurs in about 200 milliseconds, so fairly rapidly. Okay, so that's what we think is happening. Now, if that's happening, then one would predict that if you blocked the conversion of ATP to adenosine, then you should block the inhibitory response in the ganglion cells. And in fact, if one adds blockers of the ectoATPase that convert ATP to ADP, or block the ectonucleotidase that converts AMP to adenosine, one significantly reduces the inhibitory response and slows it up. And that's shown here. Here we're adding AOPCP, which blocks the ectonucleotidase. So we're blocking conversion of AMP to adenosine, and we see a much smaller inhibitory response in the neuron. Okay, so we think that this is what's happening. Now, this would predict then that when the Müller cell is stimulated, we should get a release of ATP. We already saw that ATP was released at the surface, but we'd really like to know whether ATP is being released into the synaptic layer in the retina. So, in order to test this, what we did is we used the luciferase assay. Again, remember, luciferase is the enzyme that takes ATP, hydrolyzes it, and releases light. So, the experiment I showed you before, we had luciferase in the bath. What we did now is put luciferase in a pipette and then eject a small volume of the luciferase into the synaptic layer, the inner plexiform layer, and then 5 seconds later, activate the glial cells with a mechanical stimulus, and then look and actually image the chemiluminescence to see whether any photons are released. And if we do see photons released, that means that ATP must have been released into the plexiform layer, because that's the only region where the luciferase is. Okay? And in fact, we saw this. So here we stimulate the glial cell, and then we see an increase in the chemiluminescence signal indicating that ATP is being released into within the retina. Okay? And what's more, if we add this ARL compound, which blocks the conversion of ATP to ADP, we get a significant increase in the ATP signal. So this is really showing two things. Number one, that ATP is being released into the synaptic layer. And normally, ATP is rapidly converted to ADP and then adenosine, because if we block this conversion, then there's a much bigger ATP signal. So, what we...
But all of this only involves 12% of the neurons, right?
No. It actually involves, to some extent, more than half the neurons. So, in more than half of the neurons, potentially can be inhibited by ATP release from Müller cells.
The 12% was the excitatory
one. Okay. There are two different sets of figures here. The 12% that showed excitation, that was an increase in spiking. What I think is happening is that is due to the increase, that's due to a different mechanism. Okay, I think this inhibition here that I'm showing you now due to ATP release is not actually responsible for, it could be partially responsible for the inhibition of spiking, but in fact I think depression of synaptic transmission is probably more responsible for that as well. So in fact, there are at least three different types of modulation that can occur. And it really is, it's actually, I think it makes this whole phenomenon more powerful that only subsets of the neurons are affected by the different mechanisms, because that means that glial cells can selectively modulate different types of cells. And that, I think, is happening. So again, in this type of modulation, when glial cells are activated, which we see does occur when we turn on the light, ATP is released, the ATP is converted to adenosine, and then activates adenosine receptors, which actually lead to opening of potassium channels and to an inhibition of the ganglion cells. This involves no synapses at all. Well, we don't know whether the adenosine... Actually, that's a good question. I don't know whether the adenosine receptors on the ganglion cells are at synapses or not, but it's not synaptic transmission in that the Müller cells don't directly synapse on it. It's just released into the extracellular space and it diffuses to the ganglion cell.
I was wondering whether the receptors are sitting in a synapse or whether they're on the cell body somewhere.
Yeah, actually, I'm not... sure of that. I'm not even sure if it's known. I should mention that it is known that adenosine receptors are found both on the postsynaptic membrane and at the presynaptic membrane. And so, in fact, this mechanism could also be activating presynaptic receptors. And in fact, there are two kinds of presynaptic receptors. One type would inhibit transmitter release, and the other type would excite it. So in fact, ATP release and adenosine could account for the both the synaptic potentiation and the synaptic depression that I showed you. I don't know if it does, but it potentially could.
This is amycretin.
This is amycretin, which is inhibitory. Right, so that's right. So that wouldn't account. It would be presynaptic receptors on bipolar cells, but not on amycretin cells. That's exactly right.
Also says A1 receptors.
Yes. I do not know if it's been shown in the retina. In other parts of the brain, there are both A1 and A2 presynaptic receptors. I don't know if that's true in the retina or not. But in fact, that's the kind of experiment we have to do now. And there, as I mentioned, there are ways of telling whether inhibition is and increases potentiation and depression in synaptic transmission, whether it's due to a presynaptic effect or postsynaptic. And one can do experiments to test whether it is pre or postsynaptic. So we have to do that. I'm going to quit now, but let me, something that's not in my talk but might be useful to mention, newer cells can potentially modulate synaptic transmission by a fourth mechanism. And or I don't know if you're all familiar with NMDA receptors. It's a type of glutamate receptor, and it's a special type because it's the type that's thought to be responsible at least for some types of Hebbian synaptic interactions which are thought to account for learning and memory, where it's sort of a comparator where you need two things going on, and if you have two different inputs that occur simultaneously, concurrently, then the channels open and you get long-term changes in synaptic strength. The importance is, for what I want to talk about, is that NMDA receptors are activated by glutamate, but they also have to be activated by a second co-agonist, which is always thought to have been glycine. There's a glycine binding site. Well, it turns out that it's thought now, at least by some people, that the endogenous agonist, co-agonist, for the glycine binding site is actually D-serine, a very special amino acid, which actually is a better agonist at the glycine binding site than is glycine. And this is of interest because D-serine is almost certainly synthesized and released only from glial cells. And Bob Miller and others at the University of Minnesota showed recently that D-serine is found in Müller cells, and the synthesizing enzyme for D-serine is found in Müller cells. So it's likely that the anendogenous ligand agonist for the NMDA co-agonist site is released by Müller cells, and we've actually shown that the occupation of the D-serine site is actually limiting for NMDA transmission. If one reduces D-serine in the retina, one reduces NMDA transmission. If one adds D-serine to the retina, one increases NMDA transmission. So the glycine binding site is not normally saturated, which it was thought to have been for many years. So that's another way that glial cells can modulate synaptic transmission by releasing D-serine and increasing the responses of NMDA receptors. So let me just close by summarizing the points that I've mentioned. Calcium waves can be propagated through a network of glial cells in the retina, the first example of in an intact tissue. The propagation occurs both by diffusion of an intracellular messenger and by release of ATP. In preliminary experiments, we now think that a physiological stimulus to the retina, light, leads to a calcium increase in glial cells. If one activates glial cells, one can either increase or decrease spiking. These are experiments that were done in collaboration with Kathleen Zaz, who's in the Department of Physiology at the University of Minnesota. And then in preliminary experiments, we've seen that activating glial cells can also either potentiate or depress synaptic transmission. And we think that this modulation of synaptic transmission is responsible for the change in spiking we saw. So that's two mechanisms by which glial cells can modulate ganglion cell activity. And then a third mechanism is a direct inhibition of ganglion cells by the release of ATP from Müller cells and then the activation of adenosine receptors. And finally, if you put all this together, and we've shown that glial cells can modulate the activity of neurons in many different ways, this suggests, I think strongly, that glial cells may participate in information processing in the retina and in other parts of the central nervous system as well. So I've gone on for too long, but thank you. Answered all the questions, maybe.
Given the long timescales of these signals, what kind of computation would you think are candidates for?
Well, I think one thing you could say is that clearly the glial cells, I don't think, are participating in millisecond to millisecond computations. I think this is more of a slower modulatory influence. And there are many transmitters released from neurons that also act on a very slow, even slower time scale than this. And the peptides that are released, serotonin, dopamine, in general act on a seconds time scale to actually minutes time scale for peptides. So this would clearly be more of a modulatory influence, perhaps affecting synaptic strength over seconds or minutes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Any further questions or comments, then let's thank the speaker again. And we'll come back.